Dieser Podcast wird präsentiert von Amplify Your Life, das erste Mindset-Workbook, das Achtsamkeit, Mental Health und Rock'n'Roll vereint.
Wir sind Jana Solveig und Uwe Lerch, das Powerpaar hinter diesem Buch. Für mehr Tiefe und Sinn in lauten Zeiten.
Fühlst du dich ständig erschöpft und sehnst dich nach Klarheit, innerer Ruhe und Selbstwirksamkeit?
Mit dem Spirit des Rock'n'Roll zeigen wir dir, wie du deinen inneren Verstärker wieder auf die 11 drehst. Klar, fokussiert und lebendig.
Amplify Your Life. Jetzt mehr erfahren und vorbestellen auf www.amplifyyourlife.de.
Hi everybody, this is Steve Zodiac from Vardis here. Let's all keep rocking and a-rolling to the Blog of Rock podcast. Do it.
Hallo, willkommen bei The Block of Rock, deinem Hardrock und Heavy Metal Podcast Musikmagazin. Ich bin Uwe Lerch und ich nehme dich Backstage mit zu den Rockstars. Natürlich quatschen wir über die Musik, die uns alle verbindet, über neue Platten, über Livepläne und was früher so war. Aber wir sprechen auch über die Menschen dahinter. Was hat sie inspiriert und motiviert und welche Rockstar-Tipps haben sie für dich da draußen? In den Shownotes, das ist die Beschreibung zu dieser Episode, über die du das hier gerade hörst, findest du einen zentralen Link für alle weiteren Informationen, der dich aber auch in meine offizielle Facebook-Gruppe führt. Ich würde mich freuen, wenn wir uns hier kennenlernen. Bist du nun am Start? Na dann komm doch mit! Für die heutige Episode greife ich mal ganz tief in die Schatzkiste und hole euch eine Band raus, die ich über viele Jahre, vielleicht Jahrzehnte nicht mehr auf dem Schirm hatte. Vardis. Entstanden im Norden Englands im Schmelztiegel von Glam, Punk, Heavy Metal und Rock'n'Roll. Ihre erste Platte kam 1980 auf den Markt und gab gleich mit dem Titel 100 Miles per Hour das richtige Tempo vor, also umgerechnet in 160 Stundenkilometer. Das Besondere an diesem Debütalbum, welches gleich mal in die aufstrebende New Wave of British Heavy Metal mit reingerutscht ist und es als eines der ersten Speed-Metal-Platten gilt, war damals, es war gleich ein Live-Album. Frontman und Gitarrist Steve Zodiac avancierte zu einer Kultfigur der ersten Tage und spielte mit seiner Band im August 1981 auf dem legendären Heavy Metal Holocaust Festival als Opener von unter anderem Ozzy und Motorhead. Aber aus vielen Gründen wie Rechtsstreitigkeiten, Besetzungswechsel und einer zu großen Experimentierfreudigkeit mit Saxophon, Mandoline und Dudelsack wurde es dann leider doch nichts mit der Weltkarriere und Steve Zodiac löste Mitte der 80er die Band auf und zog nach Griechenland auf eine kleine Insel. Gut 30 Jahre später wurde er über Social Media von treuen Fans aus dem Ruhestand gelockt und seitdem ist er wieder etwas aktiver. Am Freitag, den 13. März 2020, spielte er mit seiner aktuellen Vardis-Formation im Londoner 100 Club auf der Oxford Street eine Show, bevor dann am Tag drauf auch in UK alle Läden wegen der Pandemie geschlossen wurden. Die Energie dieser Show gibt's jetzt wiederum als Live-Album, quasi eine Reminiszenz an das Debüt von vor 40 Jahren. Ich dachte mir, was für eine Story, und rief ihn mal in Griechenland an, wo wir zwei Katzenpapas auch erstmal eine ungewöhnliche Einstiegsthematik hatten. Viel Spaß!
Kalispera!
Kalispera, Yui. Is it Yui?
Yui, yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, cool.
First of all, how do you feel? Where you in Greece?
It's lovely. I mean, I've been coming down here for 30 years or so, to the a little island in the Dodecanese called Kalymnos, not far from Kos and Turkey, just over the water here, the Turkish coast, Bodrum. And I've always felt at home everywhere in Europe. It's just how I feel. I mean, I I've always traveled and always felt comfortable, whether I'm in Germany or France or Scandinavia or Italy. And when I came to Greece, the food, the people, the climate, which is a big factor.
Of course, yeah.
I like a little bit of sunshine on here. It's very important for me. I don't know, maybe, yeah, I just love the people and the culture in Greece. And, you know, they sort of let it all out when they're angry, but then they're very chilled most of the time, which is pretty cool. And that's probably why my marriage to a Greek lady has lasted so long.
How's the weather?
It's lovely today, and last week was really nice. It's sort of like a British summertime. A little bit, I suppose, like Northern Germany, in the sense that, you know, the summer now at this time, it's like a Northern European summer, really. We do get a lot of rain, which is a good thing. I think it's forecast for next week at this time now. We're going to have maybe intermittent rains, like monsoon weather, for the next couple of months, maybe till the end of February. And then it starts to pick up again with some nice, warm, long sunshine. So it's really like the reverse of the British weather, where you get 8 months of winter and sort of 2 months of summer. If you're lucky, a few weeks, then maybe that's it. Whereas here, you get at least 8 months of summer weather, which is fantastic, because you get like the springtime twice a year, maybe three times a year for certain fruits. And we've got a little orchard out here, which we tender and look after. Oh, we've got some olive grove as well, that we get the olives and we press our own olive oil and stuff like this, which I just love all that stuff, you know. And we look after quite a few feral cats. The islands have lots of wild cats, and we look after them and we get them to the vets and get them neutered and cared for, because what happens is that the females, they become very pregnant all the time, basically, and it's bad for the health because the calcium levels drop with all the milk they have to produce. So they have fairly bad health. And the males, obviously, are always fighting until they get... So it's a way of sort of keeping the cat population under control, but at the same time giving them a healthier, stronger life and a nicer life. And we've got about 20 cats that come here to the house, and we give them a meal every evening. And a couple of them are pretty friendly, I have to say. They're like proper pets to us, I have to admit, a couple of them. But yeah, most of them stay quite wild, and it's good because they look after the rodent population. And the islands have always had a culture where the cats are very big in numbers, you know. But as I say, we try and keep them healthy, because especially in the winter, they don't get enough to eat. And yeah, it's a nice thing to do. It kept us very sane through the lockdown, because we had a lot of these little animals to take care of, and that made us very happy to do that job.
So you're a good cat daddy.
That's me, yeah.
Yeah. Funnily, when you're saying this, I remember the Instagram post of Rob Halford, whom you're going to share the haircut and the beard with. He seems to be into cats as well, because he's posting every Saturday this Happy Catterday pictures. So that's funny, yeah.
There you go, you see. Yeah, we have a little project on the go called Kalymnos Cats. My wife Irene, she sort of manages that, and there's a lady in France that's very close now to the project. And we've had about 200 or 300 cats neutered and healthcare this summer. And the Brigitte Bardot Foundation in France supports the project, so it's getting into quite a serious concern now, really. You know, we've got some funding from that Brigitte Bardot project, which is fantastic, really.
This is great. Yeah, I've never talked so deep with a musician about cats. It's really, really nice. But let's get into the music. It's rock and roll time, Steve. Steve, so for all of you, Yamas.
Mm. Yamas.
But for everybody, let's say younger than me, I'm 56, but for everybody who's younger than me, maybe you just short introduce yourself.
Okay, well, I'm Steve Zodiac, the founder, member, and guitar vocalist and songwriter for the old school rock band Vardis. It started as a school project back in the early 70s, and I've always written songs, and mainly on acoustic guitar. And then when I get together with drums and bass and we crank up the amplifiers, and it turns into this sort of rock and metal sort of sound. I've always been influenced from rock and roll music, going right back to my parents' record collection back in the late 50s, early 60s, all the American greats of rock and blues, Chuck Berry, Muddy Waters, Elvis, early Elvis, all this stuff. We always had this playing in the house, Hank Williams, all these guys. And so I sort of had it in my bones quite early on, this sort of rock and roll thing. And I suppose, yeah, the bands we played as school kids, as a school band, and eventually played a lot of shows in the north of England that were sort of what we had then were called working men's clubs, and basically all the coal miners and all the steel workers and all the, you know, the factory workers from Manchester, Leeds, all the way to Newcastle, Liverpool, Hull, all these big cities. They were all industrial in the 70s, and Sheffield, and we used to play these working men's clubs as kids, really, and do a few covers and a few sort of, you know, Thin Lizzy or a bit of the old status quo stuff and this kind of thing. And then I'd always written songs and wrote the words, and we started to play a few of my own pieces in the set. So we soon realized that actually if we played sort of a chart song, which in those days in the early 70s the UK pop charts was actually a rock chart, you know, you had Alice Cooper, you had Free, you had Deep Purple, you had Black Sabbath in the pop charts on top of the pops, you know, it was crazy when you think about it. And it was only later the sort of disco scene kicked in more, but in the one period just around the sort of early punk era, that's when the charts were just full of rock music, whether it was serious heavy rock or whether it was punk, it was still rock, you know. And so we played a few Vardis, a few of my tunes in with the set, and we soon realised that our songs were going down as well as some of the chart songs we were covering. And it ended up literally where I were writing so many songs that we ended up playing 90% of the set was all original music, which is pretty unheard of in the working men's clubs, because they used to like bands to play the charts, you know. And we found that our stuff was going down as well, as really well with the crowds. And that's really when it all started, because of the punk rock music thing. There were a lot of independent labels starting to sprout up, and you could actually press a few records and get distribution through Pinnacle Records in Kent at one time quite easily. And this is what we did. And the early recordings, I think it was If I Were King, we did a recording of that on our own label, and a DJ at the time who was on Radio 1, a guy called John Peel, very famous DJ in England. And he was responsible for playing a lot of new music and great stars like David Bowie and Mark Bolan and all these guys all were favourites of John Peel's. And we were driving home one evening from a show in Liverpool, I think, and we always listened to John Peel because he was on quite late at night when we were driving back home after a gig. And he just came out with this thing. Here's a record I really like. It's called If I Were King by Vardis. And it's like, we looked at each, we were like in the van driving home with all the gear in the back. And we literally were in shock. And he really raved on it. And he said it's going to be his record of the week and all this stuff. Anyway, from that, it sort of made the independent charts in the UK quite strongly and stayed in, I don't know, it was like 3 months or something, it stayed in the independent charts and it got in the heavy metal rankings. And that's how it started, really, with this guy, John Peel, playing that record and really liking it. And when I think about it now, because John Peel was sort of very into new music, so he was playing a lot of new wave stuff. He played a lot of the Stranglers and a lot of the punkier stuff, you know, the underground stuff that was going on in the punk scene around 74, 75, the Pistols, early Pistols, all that stuff. And so Vardis got played alongside all that stuff in a way, and I think he maybe thought we were a punk band or something, I don't know.
Yeah, actually, when I listened to your first album, we're going to talk about it now, nowadays, yeah. Of course, back in the days when I started to listen to heavy metal in 80, 81, 82, 83, I considered Vardis as one of these bands who were part of this new wave of British heavy metal. But when I listen to it now, with, let's say, 40 years of difference, it's not. Of course, somehow you were into this wave with the Tigers of Pantang, with Diamond Head and all these bands coming from. But when I listen to it now, I feel you weren't part. You had your own style, because you're coming, as you already described, you're coming back from the 50s and 60s with much more boogie rock and roll. So I think you were most connected to status quo in a way, and you had this punkish
rock and roll.
This punkish element, because you had, of course, the first album was guaranteed no overdubs, I remember, and it was really wild and loud. And nowadays, I would dare to say that your first album was one of the first speed metal records, even before this term was known. Would you agree on this? Are you okay with it?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I'm very honored that there's a genre of music that's developed that we're cited as part of that. And I think it's a great privilege that we are part of that. But at the time, no one really used the term metal as such. It became a term through the magazines, and I think the first sort of new wave of British heavy metal feature was in Sounds magazine. I remember, again, it was Iron Maiden, it was Leopard, it was somebody like Angel Witch, I think, and maybe the Tigers, I'm not so sure now, but we were in that sort of article, the original article that coined that phrase. And again, it was about that time where John Peel were playing the music, and it sort of came together. But I think most of the new wave of British heavy metal bands that you perceive of, they were just basically doing their own thing. All of us enjoyed heavy rock. I mean, I like my Led Zeppelin and some of the, you know, Made in Japan, Deep Purple, everybody had those albums, you know, and heavy rock was the thing. But I also enjoyed some of the rock, more rock and roll stuff from the 60s, like the Rolling Stones and Rory Gallagher particularly influenced my thinking a hell of a lot. And I suppose in a way, we sort of stuck to that sort of, as you say, that boogie rock based on the Chuck Berry style of electric guitar playing, and even Jimi Hendrix to some extent, because he was the main reason I first wanted to learn how to play electric guitar. I'd never even thought about it. And we bunked off school one day to go and see this film Woodstock at the cinema when it first came out. I can't remember what year that was. It was either 1970 or 71. I can't remember exactly when the Woodstock Festival happened. Now, it must have been around that time, or 69. But anyway, it was in the cinema. We went to see it. And when Hendrix did Star Spangled Banner, something clicked in my psyche, and I thought, I have to learn how to play one of those guitars, those electric guitars. And it became an obsession that I had to learn how to do this play. And so really, it's never left me, that moment of inspiration that he gave me through that movie. Not that I wanted to emulate him, but he opened my mind to discover what the electric guitar was all about and the power of it. Because in a way, even though there were other great guitar players, and going right back to the 50s, obviously, he was the first man, in my opinion, to use the valve amplifier as an instrument. So not only could he play guitar as good as, or if not better than anyone in the world at the time, but he was playing this valves in the amplifier like a synthesizer almost, creating this loop of sound between him as a musician, what we call the bone tone, the way you can subtly change the sound just by a simple little attack on the string or whatever it is, and allowing the guitar to loop itself and almost semi-feedback on the edge of anarchy through the amplifier. And I'd sort of cottoned onto that through seeing this movie, that this is more than just a guy playing a guitar. This is a guy playing an amplifier, playing an expression through his presence, his body, his whole stance, everything about him. And I think that intrigued me and fascinated me as a kid, and I became obsessive in pursuing that, really, in pursuing the idea that you can make these incredible sounds, not just music, but noise, sound, out of these instruments and the amplifiers. And I think people like Rory Gallagher and even, as I said earlier, Mark Bolan with the T-Rex thing, even Ronnie Wood with the faces, where the way they sort of created their own unique sounds in these bands, it was incredible. When you think back, the diversity of each band, whether it was Slade or whatever it was unique. The guitar sounds were unique. And I think that's why I was obsessed in trying to create something that made a statement, an individual statement. And I'd never really thought about it before that movie, no. And that's why I'd learned to play guitar. And I became obsessive, and I played it every day for 5 years to learn how to play.
So going forward, when you first listened to your song on the radio when John Peel played If I Were King, did you have a moment when you thought, oh, you and the guys in the back seats, you could go in the same direction as Jimi Hendrix or The Faces or Rory Gallagher could go? So were you really dreaming of this rock star life?
You know, I suppose so. We used to go and see all these bands and all. I mean, I never saw Jimi Hendrix. He unfortunately passed away before I'd even started going to any gigs. But I did see all the other bands and all the great rock bands. So I used to go to Manchester Bellevue and to Sheffield City Hall, and all the great artists and bands played. And so, yes, the idea that you can perform and get on a stage and create this energy, and this energy that brings you as a one dimension with the audience. So in other words, when you perform, if you've got it right, and the audience are with you, it's like one energy. So the audience is experiencing what you're experiencing, and the performers are also the audience. It's the same energy. And I realized that, having been to some of the big concerts as a kid, I realized that the same feeling, the same energy when I go on stage now, I feel the same as I did when I was a kid watching Rory Gallagher or David Bowie or whoever it might be, you know, Ziggy Stardust or one of the first acts I saw, and Mick Ronson. He was an inspiration as a guitar player, just the theatre of it. I mean, I don't know if many metal fans are aware of the Ziggy Stardust album and the impact that had on the show, being a show, you know, live. That was a phenomenal thing to see. And it made you think outside of just being a guitar player, in the same way that Hendrix did the same thing. It was out of the box. It was incredible, really. So was, yeah,
was Mick Ronson also kind of inspiration for you on, you know, on your stage look? Because I remember when I had a look at the old album artworks, you had this really really long blonde hair. You had no, you were let's say topless. You had no shirt on stage. It was quite wild, same like Mick Ronson back in the early 70s.
Yeah, partly. Yeah, I think so. It was that uninhibited sort of way of just expressing yourself. I mean, it was always very hot, and most rock and metal in those days, it was full on, and it wasn't long before you were absolutely saturated and the shirts came off anyway, sort of thing. But yeah, I used to, I mean, that's the other thing. I think if Vardis had have had Mohican haircuts and all the rest of it, we might well have been more in the punk genre, maybe. I don't know. I mean, some, not all of it, but some of it, it's definitely in that sort of buzz, I think. But yeah, the theatre is something that attracted me, the idea that it's a show and that you can express your music and your performance through certain key moments of sort of theatrics, if you like. And we always like to do the synchronized sort of boogie-woogie bits with the guitars and stuff. And we still do. Me and Rowley do it, and we did it at the 100 Club. And, you know, the energy and the sound, apart from my voice, which has obviously matured into a more bluesy sound as I've got bigger, more Pavarotti. apart from that, the actual energy, the essence of the band hasn't changed. I mean, the chemistry is what's important. And when me and Alan and Gary made the first 100 Miles an Hour, there was a great chemistry within those three musicians. And I have to say, this band has got that energy. It's resurfaced. And if you didn't know that we were a bunch of guys, you know, middle age and above, you wouldn't really, you'd really think that the band were quite youthful still. And I like that because music is timeless, you know, it really is. And rock music particularly, it does transcend time. And that's why it transcends generations.
That's for sure. The crazy thing is when I first got the idea that I could have you as a guest in my show, I listened again to the old live album because I haven't got the new one. So I listened to 100 Miles per Hour from 1980. And I remembered every song, even though I haven't heard it for maybe 30 years' time. I remembered every song by heart. I remembered this energy of this live album, which was a cult album. And to me, 100 Miles per Hour, the original one, is in the same level as No Sleep Till Hammersmith, which is obviously one of the best live albums ever recorded, because the energy on this album was tremendously. You really could hear it. You really could hear it. And I always was thinking, why the hell had these guys the first chosen the first release as a live release and coming back as the studio albums after? So it was quite unusual. What was the reason for it?
Because, as I said previously, we played original songs in to the working men's clubs for a couple of years, and so we already had a set tight live that we knew we could play live. And when you go in a recording studio, it's a very alien environment. It's the energy of, as I said, the audience and the band isn't there. And although you play well and you make really good recordings, and we did a couple of singles at the time and so on. And in fact, the first If I Were King was a studio version. But it was always, there's always that element that I just felt we didn't quite get. And so we had all these songs and we were really good at playing them live. And it just came out of nowhere. We just thought, well, why don't we just record it and see what it sounds like? It was that simple, really. And thankfully, Logo Records thought, well, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do it. I don't think anybody realized that we were probably one of the very first bands to ever have a go at doing that. And maybe if we'd have thought about it enough, maybe we would have not bothered, because it were like, it's quite risky, I suppose, to just put everything out on tape live. And I think what happened was, and it's still true to this day to some extent, most live albums are pretty much, there's always like where you go and you retrack a bum note or a little bit of vocal that's out of tune and all the rest of it. I mean, it's quite common practice. I'm not knocking anybody who does it, because it's not, a good album or a great album is still a great album. It's not something that people that should be, you know, I'm not saying anyone's wrong for retracking mistakes or whatever you want to call them, or getting it better. We're all perfectionists. We all want the best we can be. But the idea for me was, I think on 100 Miles an Hour, the original, we recorded a couple of shows, two shows on Mickey Mouse's Rack Mobile system. And we thought, if we can get a selection of tracks that are played really well, it'll capture what the Vardis energy is, and it's a great way to launch the band with some serious recording on a serious record label. Now, the thing is, and I think Joe Clancy, my drummer now, he pointed out to me that the 100 Club, there's not many albums recorded on one show and released from one show. And when I think about that, it's actually quite a pressure to have done the 100 Club the way we did it, because even 100 Miles an Hour was two shows, and most bands record a tour and then they take the best performances from out of all the shows. But yeah, I mean, of course, back in the day, the record label did say to us, look, we'd like you to go back in the studio and overdub a little bit of something's out of tune there, or some of my vocals. And I said, no, I wouldn't feel right doing that. I just think it's a moment in time. It is what it is, and it's who we are. And in fact, I doubled down and said, I want a sticker going on to assure the fans that we've not tampered with the actual recordings in that way. Of course, the recording timeline has to be shortened, all the spiel in between, because it has to fit on vinyl, which is about 20 minutes a side, half an hour if you're lucky, but it's not usually good quality. You have to really be careful for the vinyl cut in terms of time. And so when we did the 100 Mile an Hour at the 100 Club, we have got the show in a linear fashion to how we played on the night. And yeah, I again insisted that we, although obviously the edits have to bring it into a time frame that fits on vinyl, the actual tracks are exactly what the audience were getting on the night. And you say you've not got the album.
Yes. I'm coming to this now, because after we have arranged this call, of course, luckily I was getting the new copy of the album by Björn from SPD. Cool. And awesome. The funny thing is, of course, you know, if you take a look at the artwork, at the new artwork and the old artwork, of course there are some similarities. And if you listen to it, it's the same kind of energy. Of course, we all have grown older, but it's the same kind of energy. And I really enjoyed it. Of course, there are some other tracks than on the original recorders, because you have released some more albums afterwards. Yeah. But the energy, and this is something which, you know, which I felt the same way than 40 years ago when I tried to compare it with, you know, No Sleep Till Hammers. It's still the same. Yeah. Even, and this is something which I really enjoyed, you start on the new release, you know, you start like a blues singer and then later on became the Pavarotti again within the sets. Yeah. But this is something which I really enjoyed, that you didn't overdub it. Yeah. And it's strictly written on the album artwork, again, guaranteed no overdubs. And this is what Vardis stands for. That's your trademark.
We do. For live music, yeah, it has to be. That's correct. And I'm so pleased you got the album and find it a good album, because we really did want to pay a tribute to the 40 years, you know. I mean, it's like, my God, what happened? Time just, you know, life's too short. Even when you live a long time, it still goes so quick, you know. And And we wanted to just pay homage to that a little bit with the sleeve. And yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, it was an incredible night, really, the 100 Club, because we didn't even know if it were going to be possible when the coronavirus started big time coming across to Britain, and that we were getting no guidance from the government. There was no, nobody knew what was happening. And funnily enough, when I was offered to do the 100 Club show, I were offered two dates on the third Friday the 13th or Saturday the 14th. And I looked at it, and of course, Saturday night is usually the best night. As Elton John says, Saturday night's all right for fighting. Well, yeah, it's the same with rock and roll, I suppose. It's usually the best. And I just looked at this Friday the 13th, and I thought, it has to be Friday the 13th, for God's sake. We have to do it on that. And it's the luckiest thing we've ever done, because the UK got locked down on Friday, on Saturday the 14th. It's incredible when I think
about it. So really, it was one of the last shows which has been recorded.
It was the last show, yeah. We came off, it was a two-hour set. We went on stage about 9, came off just after 11. And we, to my knowledge, we were the last band off the West End stage, last music, live music, for another 12, 14 months. After that, everything. It's just, I don't know how we managed to do it now when I think about it. But it was meant to be. It's as if the stars aligned to get that album in the can. Yeah.
This is crazy. This is really crazy. Do you follow the modern rock and metal scene from your place where you live?
Yeah, I mean, rock and metal in Greece is quite big. You know, there's a lot of rock fans in Greece, and so many good young bands out there. Yeah, of course, we listen to quite a few tracks from many young bands coming through. You know, to me, though, it's like there's so many generations gone by in 40 years. It's like I remember one of the things I remember when we played the Keep It True Festival in Germany was how diverse the audience was, and there were a lot of older fans there, but there were also a lot of young kids listening to Vardis for the first time, and that sort of made me realise how rock music transcends, again, generations, and rock and roll fundamentally does, you know. If you listen to a Little Richard track from the 50s or so, and you hear that voice, and it's like, oh my God, it's just unbelievable. And anyone into rock and metal knows what good music or good rock music is. And I think young fans, you know, broaden your mind, find out where music and blues came from, because some of those great old artists are still, the records are still well worth listening to. And I think if you're a musician, especially, and you want an inspiration as a guitar player or a singer, it's passed on from generation to generation, I feel. And so I take a very strong view on playing to diverse and younger audiences, and we played a show in Leicester called Uprising about 3-4 years ago with Napalm Death, who are quite a big, are they grind metal or what are they, what's the genre for Napalm Death? Anyway, it's not the same as N-Wolf, that's for sure. But there was also lots of other young bands on that show, and lots of other different metal styles and contemporary style, and I just wanted to play a show where there was no nostalgia factor for Vardis involved, just to see what we could do. And honestly, it was incredible, because the youngsters, well, to me the youngsters, but they were just like in and on it straight away, and it were like we were again going back to the late 70s, early 80s, with like everybody discovering the headbanging sort of ways. It was, and I think it just gave me a lot of heart and a lot of confidence that good rock and roll music will never die, and it'll always connect, the energy connects. And so, yeah, metal is a way of expressing rock and roll music in different genres in the modern world. And, of course, there are different studio techniques and different sounds that a lot of the new generation people are creating and discovering. Some of them, no, I don't quite grasp. But, yeah, I mean, overall, I think the energy and a lot of the stuff is, you know, it's the same as it's always been. In the same way as I always felt the songs of the Sex Pistols could have actually been played by the Rolling Stones. You know, they're actually just rock and roll songs, you know, pretty vacant. Could have easily been a Rolling Stones record. Obviously, vocally, it would have been very different, but you understand in terms of songwriting.
I've never thought about this. I've never thought about this. Just coming back to my comparison to Motorhead, because I remember that even Lemmy never considered himself as a heavy metal musician. He also referred a lot of to the, let's say, to Chuck Berry, Little Richard, and he was a really big rock and roll enthusiast. And there was one big, big festival, which sadly I did not attend, but you played with Motorhead on the Heavy Metal Holocaust.
That's correct, yeah.
This was one of the most legendary festival we've heard in Germany at that time.
Yeah, was that the one with Ozzy Osbourne at Port Vale football ground? Yeah. Yeah, that was one of the very first sort of mega festivals for rock and metal, because all the other festivals that to that point, whether it was Reading Festival or Glastonbury or whatever, they were more sort of, they were a range of acts, whether it was folk or rock and roll or soul, or they had a different types of music. And I think that the Port Vale show was the first time that pure hard and heavy rock music was put on for a day-long festival. We opened that show. We were the first band on, and I don't think there was any sort of health and safety regulations in those days much, and I think the crowd just kept coming in and coming in, and by the time we'd gone on stage, it was just like as far as you could see, just people, and just like crammed in, and it was incredibly hot day. I remember it was early August, I think, and it was really hot, and it was a real party atmosphere, like almost like backstage was like a family barbecue sort of thing. And I mean, yeah, Lemmy used to come and see Vardis quite a bit in the old days when we first used to play shows in London, and it was just nice to see all the bands there, and Ozzy Osbourne was there. I'd met him a couple of times at Shepperton Studios. They used to rehearse down there, the first Blizzard. It was a really good atmosphere. And yeah, I've never been on a stage that big before, and it was huge, big canopy stage. And I remember going on, and we were really well received. There were a warm reception. We couldn't hear a damn thing. It was the biggest sound system in the world at the time. And me and Alan were just like, and we're just going for it by instinct, you know. You sort of bounce off the vibe, really. And we knew it went like this. We were on stage about an hour, and it just went in a flash, literally. And I remember they were shouting for more of the crowd, which was fantastic. And we just thought, yeah, don't matter. Don't worry about the fact that we couldn't hear a damn thing, you know. The crowd enjoyed it. That's all that matters. And it was a great day. And it's fondly remembered by everybody, I think, really, yeah.
For me, it's a historical thing, because I've been a journalist now for almost 40 years, but I've never spoke to somebody about this festival. So this is for me also something I could strike off my bucket list right now. But don't talk always about the past. Let's look into the future. And I would like to end off with a Latin quote. Quo vadis, Steve?
Nah, where are you going? In simple talk, yes, which is really, why I chose the name in the first place was that at the time when I was a kid, around the time I saw Jimi Hendrix on Woodstock, I was a bit lost because my father had just died, if I'm being brutally honest, and I was sort of emotionally in a bit of a state. I was only a young boy. And so when I started the band, I didn't know where I was going. And so I thought, well, if I use this, I knew the movie Quo Vadis, you see, and the Latin meaning of this, and that's why I chose that. And so now we're back, and it's a different sort of where are you going? I think the whole world has to decide where it's going at the moment. Because to coin another phrase, it is a little bit insane at the moment, the world. But yeah, I think we're just enjoying ourselves. I'm still writing my songs, so sit and get together with my guitar, and we knock out together a little tune here and there. My songs tend to come as inspirational. I pick up on something, or something just pops in, or I play a riff and I think, is that someone's riff or is it mine? And I have to really think about it sometimes. And then I develop the songs on the acoustic guitar. And then normally, and the way we did the Red Eye album, Terry came down and we worked in my studio down here, crafted the material a little bit here for a few weeks, and then went back to London to finish off the backing tracks. So, I mean, yeah, the 100 Mile an Hour at the 100 Club has been a godsend, really, in the sense that because of the file sharing and the internet, myself and Joe Clancy have been able, I mean, Joe's a brilliant mix engineer as well as a drummer, I have to say. And he really did a great job with the mix. And I've got a mastering studio here, which I could then analyse and work on getting the product finished and ready for SPV. So we had a good working relationship on the Red Eye project, but with this one during lockdown, we were able to get it finished and ready for release. That's why really it is a little bit late, because the anniversary was 2020. So theoretically the 40 years for 100 Miles an Hour was last year, but we got it done, and hopefully people are going to enjoy it just as much as they enjoyed the original record. And I hope they see that we have pushed the boundaries a little bit more now. I didn't want to replicate the sound. When Vadis play, we always have a lot of expressive intuition with each other, and I like to leave sections in the music where people and Joe and Rowley can really express themselves, and we let the music carry us along with the audience. Maybe that's sort of, again, the sort of Rory Gallagher way of doing things as well, that sort of Hendrix thing, that you just go for something and almost like ad-libbing some of the, especially the solo stuff, you know. And so, yeah, lockdown, we were busy doing that, and I'm hoping next spring, all being well, if coronavirus can be controlled, we're already penciling in shows, a couple of shows in the UK, and I'm hopeful that we'll get some in Germany and France as well in the near future for that time frame in the spring, maybe March, April time. But it's so difficult to predict which way this road is going to turn with this virus. I mean, I know it's difficult for a lot of people, but for everybody, but we have to get this thing under control. And I think just as we get malaria under control and we get measles and all these other viruses and diseases, people have to be serious about it. Because honestly, one of my friends, Henning, actually, who lived here in Kalymnos, very good friend of mine for many years. He was a bit older than me. He was 70, but very strong guy. He'd lived here in Kalymnos for about 7 years. He got coronavirus, and they airlifted him back to Germany, and he died within 2 weeks. And he was a fit, strong guy. Now, yeah, it does make you think, what can you do? What action can we all take as individuals to get this thing under control? I know there's all the debate as to why it's here and this and that, but it is real. And it, as I say, I was skeptical to start with. I was thinking, oh, maybe it's a flu bug or something, and we can, you know, what can we do?
Same, actually, same like me. Yeah, it's something I'm missing the live shows as well, but at the moment, it's something where in between this pandemic, I invented my podcast. Because I couldn't go out to shows. So I was trying to invite all my favorite bands to my computer. And we had nice talks. And actually, Steve, I must say, we've never met so far. Because for whatever reasons, Vardis disbanded actually when I was starting my career as a journalist even further. And I got interviewed. I got interviews with a lot of artists. And we never met so far. And because it was a... you know, an incidental thing that SQV was asking me if I got, if I would be able and had, you know, had the time to interview it. I said immediately, I want to do this because this is something. And I must say, this was one of my favorite talks so far in my podcast. Hey. And last thing I wanted to ask you, especially when I listen to the old stuff, of course, still the voice is still there. But, you know, when I listen to the old stuff, I know where Michael Paulsen from Volbeat got his vocal inspirations from. Is this something somebody have told you?
Oh, I've not heard that before. No, I have to admit. But yeah, I mean, yeah,
you know, is this rock and roll Elvis type, Little Richard type of vocal? Which was your trademark as well. But when you listen to Volbeat now with this mindset, and you listen to old Vardis, there, you know, it's a kind of energy, and this vocal thing is something which is quite comparable.
It's not having any inhibition. It's like just letting it out there.
Yeah.
You know, you put everything out. I mean, the one thing that Vardis have always done, and I as the front man believe, is that you've got to just do your best, give it everything you've got. Otherwise, there's just no point. I got offered a lot of opportunities to come back and play for other bands, some of them quite big bands, but I never took the opportunities because I didn't feel I could express myself the way I can with Vardis. One of the reasons I wrote the songs in the first place was very personal to me. So the reason I wanted to play music was very personal. And I suppose that's why I was able to sort of stop doing it, because it is addictive. Adrenaline is addictive. And it's the biggest, most powerful drug that as a performer you can have. You know, you do that for 6 years, 8 years, every night more or less, and this adrenaline's pumping through your system, and then all of a sudden you have to stop, which I decided to do. It can drive you crazy. So I understand why sometimes football players and boxers and athletes, they get problems, because you can do that for 30 years at the top, say as a superstar footballer. And then all of a sudden it's gone. You can't do it. Your bones don't want to do it anymore. And it was Irene, my wife, who said to me, you know, when I first got asked to come back and play after 30 years, nearly 27 years, she says, if you were a football player, you wouldn't be able to come back and play after 27 years. And she said, I can tell you, you can play guitar today just as good as you've ever played it, if not better. So get out there and give it a go. So without that good woman putting me in the right direction, maybe I would have.
So thanks to Irene. Yeah.
Exactly.
This is great. This is actually great. It
happened, yes.
So Steve, get out and go steaming along.
I will. I'll steam along, my friend. Cool.
So
I'm glad you like the album.
I do. All the best. Cheers, Yamas and Kali Nichta. You're already 1 hour ahead of my time.
Kali Nichta. Yasas. Bye-bye for now.
Wenn dir diese Episode gefallen hat, folge mir doch gerne beim Podcast-Dealer deines Vertrauens, damit du auch die nächste Folge nicht verpasst. Du bekommst die ganze Staffel als kostenloses Abo unter anderem bei Spotify, Apple Podcast, Amazon Music,
Deezer, Soundcloud, YouTube, dem Podcast-Portal von Google oder natürlich über meine Homepage theblogofrock.com. Höre dir dort auch die bereits veröffentlichten Stories an, denn jede Woche gibt es hier neues Futter. Und vor allem, erzähle es deinen Freunden und teile die frohe Kunde auf Social Media. Alles klar? Dann hören wir uns ja wieder beim nächsten Mal. Bis dahin, keep on rocking!
Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.